This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The countdown is underway for NASA's first Independence Day launch of a space shuttle. In about 8 minutes' time, we expect the shuttle Discovery to blast off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Today's launch is NASA's third try to get this shuttle off the ground. Bad weather scrubbed attempts on Saturday and Sunday. Yesterday, inspectors found a crack in the shuttle's foam insulation and a 3-inch chunk of foam that had fallen off. Last night, NASA officials decided that the cracked foam did not pose a danger, so if the weather holds at the launch site, Discovery will lift off for its mission to the International Space Station. Joining me here in Studio 3A is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. We're also joined by David Kestenbaum, NPR science correspondent, overlooking the launch site in Florida. Also in Florida, Carl Waltz, former astronaut and associate director of the Life Support and Habitation Program for the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate at NASA. And David, how are things looking down there at the launch site?
This is the best we've seen it. The sky looks totally clear. There's a little wind, but they've already decided that's not a problem. The flags are flying strong. There's an American flag, and below that there's a flag that says Discovery on it for the Discovery Space Shuttle.
And the problems with the foam, what went into the decision? Obviously, foam is blamed for the disasters in the past. Why overlook a problem this time around?
There were a few things they wanted to consider. One was they wanted to make sure there wasn't going to be any more foam coming off, and they got some very close-up photographs of the area where the foam had come loose, and they didn't see any danger of that. They wanted to make sure there was still enough foam there to protect the shuttle. The shuttle's tank. The tank is actually quite thin, a fraction of an inch thick, and when it goes up, it can get quite hot, so they need enough foam there. They weren't worried about that, and they said they feel like they understood why it came off. There was some ice that had formed after a rainy day, which had pinched a joint, and some of the foam had popped off. So they felt like this was a phenomenon they understood, and there was enough foam left. And the piece they found was actually quite small. They had it in a Ziploc bag. It was described a crust of bread about that big.
So considerably smaller than the chunk that caused the problems last time.
That was described as being the size of a briefcase.
So very different. There were, though, some other problems with the launch. Again, nothing that's going to scrub the flight, though.
There were problems with a thermostat on one of the thrusters. It's a small thruster, nothing you need for launch. It's one of the things that's used for subtle maneuvers in space for docking with the International Space Station. And it's one of six that are broken that will not be able to work, but they can get by with the other five. They did have to decide to go through a procedure and get a waiver for that, but they did that. And so they're go for launch today.
That's NPR's David Kestenbaum with us from Cape Canaveral in the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Richard Harris is with me here in the studio in Washington. Richard, there's a very small window in which this shuttle will either take off or it's going to be postponed again.
That's exactly right, Neil, because this space shuttle has to get to the International Space Station, which is in orbit, and you have to launch. They basically have 5 minutes from the time zero today to get up into that orbit, because they're going to spend a couple days chasing it around the planet and trying to catch up with it. And if it launches too much later than that, they'll never catch up, so they won't even try.
So it's all planetary and celestial mechanics as they're trying to use the least amount of fuel to catch up to the space station.
Right. They have to. The space station really would be out of reach if they tried to launch at 4 o'clock this afternoon or something like that.
And tell us a little bit about the mission of this particular flight.
Well, the main point of this mission really is to test some of the repairs that they've made over the last several years since the Columbia tragedy in 2003. They're also bringing a bunch of cargo up to the space station. And a new astronaut up there who's going to spend 6 months up there.
A West German astronaut.
Indeed.
German astronaut. West German is a... we're beginning to hear some of the broadcast from NASA. We'll be taking you to that when they get down to the countdown, and the shuttle is actually expected to take off in roughly 3.5 minutes' time. So the mission is to the International Space Station, but this is a mission with a limited amount of time. The shuttle itself is set to expire in the year 2010, Richard.
That's right. They only have really budget and really only the space station. The space shuttle is really, really old, and they want to get it out of service as quickly as possible. So they're going to make as many launches as they can between now and the end of 2010, at which point they're going to just stop the program. So they're hoping there could be 16 or 17 launches, but, you know, if they have more delays the way we've seen the last couple of years, it could be substantially fewer than that.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen in anyway as the feed comes to us from NASA. This is Bruce Buckingham, the anchor at Launch Control at Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
T-minus 3 minutes and counting. Everything is looking good for launch today, hoping to add to the country's 4th of July Independence Day celebrations.
And it could be quite a fireworks show. Let's go down to Florida. Astronaut Carl Woltz, you're a veteran of 4 space flights yourself. Can you tell us how you felt at 3 minutes to launch?
Well, you get really busy, especially if you're on the flight deck. There's a lot of things that are going through your mind. You're working with the checklist. You connect the fuel cells to the buses. You start the auxiliary power units. And so the space shuttle now seems like it's alive. It's vibrating, doing flight control checks.
Do you have any time at all to thrill to the moment that you're about to do what you dreamed of doing ever since you were a little boy?
Well, this is where the adrenaline starts to build.
This is where the adrenaline starts to build.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Once you're inside of 9 minutes, this is you're really focused.
Let's go back to NASA.
T-minus 2 minutes and counting.
So we're still on track, and David Kestenbaum, as I understand it, once we're at this point, well, they're going to go.
There is a possibility of a hold at 30 seconds. We'll see if they decide to execute that for some thermal conditioning of a part of the rocket. But it may just run straight down. It's at 1 minute, 37 seconds. They can. Carl, you had a time where they stopped with just a few seconds left, right?
Yeah, that is a potential occurrence as well, though it's a fairly low probability where the main engine start and then shut down before you actually lift off. But I think this will sail sail right down, hopefully.
Carl,
once they light the solid rocket boosters, there's no turning them off. So at that point,
you're
going to wait a while to come back.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And the countdown is underway. We heard already earlier 90 seconds and counting, and let's see if we can get an update from Canaveral.
T-minus 60 seconds and counting.
All right, so in 1 minute, Carl, we've heard so many descriptions of that. Just describe it for us in your own words, what it felt like the first time.
We are transferring to
a very, just a lot of vibration, a whole lot of shaking. That's what I would characterize the launch process as.
All right, everybody's getting ready for that shaking. There are 7 astronauts aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery. The launch is set for, 35 seconds from now, and we're going to be bringing it to you live.
And we have a go for auto sequence start. Discovery's onboard computers have primary control of all the vehicle's critical functions. T-minus 17 seconds and counting. 15, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. Go for main engine start. Main engine start.
You're listening
to
NPR News.
1, booster ignition, and liftoff of the Space Shuttle Discovery.
Wow.
Returning to the
fabulous
space station, paving the way for future missions beyond.
The shuttle is making that familiar roll turn as it goes onto its back after lifting off from Cape Canaveral and roaring into the night. David Kestenbaum, can you describe what you see?
Wow, it is just shockingly bright when you see it. It's the biggest firework ever, going straight up, a huge trailing white cloud behind it. At the beginning, you really have to almost look away because it'll feel like it'll burn your retina. It's getting smaller, and there's just a column of smoke behind it going straight down to the ground.
Carl Woltz, when you're in that space, do you feel that roll? I mean, you're being pressed back so far into your seat. Do you feel the roll at all?
You really don't feel the roll. You can see it, though, if you look out the windows, you can see the roll. All of a sudden, you're looking at the ocean. You could see the smoke down from the launch pad, and we're getting the throttle down now, the throttle up, and you're pressed down in your seat about 3 G's as you're accelerating into space.
Mm-hmm. The next critical moment would be the separation of the solid rocket boosters.
That's correct. Yeah, and that's about 2 minutes.
Lindsay Jones.
That's a big milestone there.
The shuttle at this point has already burned. It's half as heavy as it was when it started. It's gone through a tremendous amount of fuel in the beginning.
That is NPR's David Kestenbaum at the Kennedy Space Flight Center in Florida. Also with us, astronaut Carl Woltz. Richard Harris is with us here in the studio in Washington, and I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to NPR News.
Solid rocket
this
booster
is,
should have just separated.
And this is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. About 2 minutes ago, the Space Shuttle Discovery launched from the Kennedy Space Center on a mission to the International Space Station.
Okay, yeah.
With me is NPR's David Kestenbaum in Florida, along with astronaut Carl Walls and Richard Harris, NPR science correspondent with me here in Studio 3A in Washington, D.C. David Kestenbaum, have we seen the separation of the solid rocket boosters?
Yeah, actually, you can see it. It's a small, bright thing coming down. That's the solid rocket booster. And that actually, interestingly, has some of cameras and images on it. And there are 100 cameras, over 100 cameras focused on this launch because they really want to get a good look at it and make sure nothing hit the heat shields. And some of the cameras are on the solid rocket boosters, and those they're falling quite slowly. When those eventually land in the ocean, they fish them out. And so they won't have those images for a little bit. But some of the others they get quite quickly.
Mm-hmm. And Carl Walsh, the rocket is also being chased by aircraft, T-38s, no?
No, not for this. No, although we, most of our instrumentation is on the ground and then in space on the vehicle itself. So, yeah, we didn't have any 38s in the air. Usually we may chase them for landing.
I may chase them for landing, I see, for different kinds of purposes. But obviously in the past several years, any angle that people can find to put a camera on the space shuttle, they're going to do it.
That's correct, yeah.
All
especially,
right.
Trying to understand the foam issues.
On the foam issues, because that has been such a problem, and making sure it may have been all right to get into space, as we've learned, but may present a problem going down. Anyway, let's go back to NASA.
Discovery nearing the point of negative return, where the shuttle would be too far downrange, too high in altitude to return to the launch site in the event of an engine failure.
And that was Bruce Buckingham, the anchor at Launch Control at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. And Richard Harris here in Washington, if memory serves, if that option is gone, the next one is to abort to a landing field in Spain.
That's correct. If they can get across the Atlantic, they do that. And if they actually, if the failure is a little bit farther downstream than that, they have other abort options, one of which is called abort once around, which is they go around the Earth once and then they land. Or there's such a thing as abort to orbit, which sounds like an oxymoron, because if you're in orbit, it doesn't sound like an abort. But in this case, it would mean not getting up to the altitude of the space station. So they'd be up there and they'd be safely in orbit, but they wouldn't be able to complete their mission to get to the space station, at least.
Tell us, this is the second flight since the disaster of Columbia, and the first in almost a year. Why did it take so long to get back on schedule?
Well, it took a long time between 2003, when the Columbia disaster came along, and to really come up with some fixes for it. And they thought that they had some good fixes in place, but the launch last July, turned out to reveal that the fixes weren't quite fixes. And so it was back to the drawing board yet again to fix some of these issues with falling foam. That's the real issue. Foam is so lightweight. It was only a pound and a half of foam that fell off the space shuttle, but it was moving in 2003. But it's moving at such an incredible velocity that it's able to punch a hole in the space shuttle. So they really wanted to make sure that they had that right and make sure that no more than a fraction of a pound could come out.
Let's get another update from Bruce Buckingham at Launch Control at Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
Heads-up position through the swiveling of its main engines, enabling the shuttle to gain more favorable communications through the tracking and data relay satellite as it heads uphill.
Houston, press to ATO, select ISTRAS.
And that's Rob Nabius. Now talking to us from Houston rather than from the Space Flight Center there in Florida. And let's go back to David Kestenbaum. What can you see there, David?
Now the cloud turns into a real cloud. It starts out as very thin, and it just looks like there's the biggest, strangest cloud you've ever seen, very low and over the launch pad, drifting to one side. We're nearing the point where they're going to have to throttle down because the shuttle actually loses so much weight with the as it burns through its fuel that it would get going too fast, so they have to throttle back now that it's lighter.
Going too fast?
But it's an acceleration, and they try to maintain the acceleration at a maximum of three times the force of gravity, or 3 G's, and that's to protect the flight control systems and the vertical stabilizer on the space shuttle. The people can take more, mm-hmm. but they want to protect the vehicle.
Because the vehicles are, obviously you want to protect the vehicle, or the people have considerable difficulties.
But at this point, I think you start to have a nice view now that they've rolled over.
Yeah.
What do you? What would you be seeing at this point?
Well, you just you'd be getting toward the. Toward the edge of space, and you just you know, you start to get some great views of the Earth, and you know, it's just you're starting to really, you know, feel like you're a space traveler at this point.
Mm-hmm. Richard Harris, we've had the separation, we've had the roll, then the separation of the solid rocket boosters. What's the next big event as the shuttle continues on its way towards orbit?
Well, if all goes well, all three main engines will continue to burn until a point called MECO, or main engine cutoff, and at which point they're basically gliding in orbit. That's about usually 8.5 minutes into the flight. At that point, they're basically their momentum will carry them from there, at least into their initial orbit.
Into their initial orbit. Main engine cutoff, the big tank, the big fuel tank, does that come off at that point?
Yes, that's when it comes out, because it's no longer needed.
And that, of course, will not be recovered. It will fall back to Earth and burn up in the atmosphere along the way. I guess some pieces of it make back, presumably those pieces of foam, which are so sturdy. Let's go back to Rob Nabius and Houston.
Minutes, 15 seconds into the flight. Everything looking good on Discovery, standing by for main engine cutoff. That will be followed a few seconds later by the separation of the external fuel tank.
And we're awaiting the signal that indeed main engine cutoff has occurred.
And Neil, one thing that
the booster officer reports that we have main engine cutoff, standing by for external tank separation.
One thing that's interesting is we actually have cameras that NASA has not often offered this view of from the space shuttle, but they actually do have cameras that are giving a live image of the main engine, of the
external tank separation confirmed. Commander Steve Lindsay now maneuvering Discovery to the correct orientation so that video and digital stills of the external tank can be captured by cameras embedded in the shuttle's umbilical well. A smooth ride to orbit for the shuttle Discovery, embarking
so that's an incredible
on what
view.
Is expected
this is taken
to be
from a camera.
A 13-day mission.
Carl Waltz, could you tell us, main engine cutoff, what does that feel like?
Well, you're going from 3Gs to 0Gs almost instantaneously, and so all of a sudden things that felt very heavy now are floating, and so it's just a fabulous feeling, and you are really in space there.
And I imagine that adrenaline that was building up, well, if it's possible to peak, it's peaking now.
Oh, absolutely, because, you know, you're getting that fabulous view of the Earth, and you're truly weightless, and now the crew is getting out of their seats, they're pulling out cameras, and they're going to start taking pictures of that external tank.
And to record any information they can possibly get. Richard Harris, fill us a little bit more in on the significance of this mission, beginning to realize halfway through 2006, the retirement of the space shuttle as a vehicle itself, not all that far off.
Yes, indeed. And really, this mission is primarily a test flight to make sure that the fixes that they've put in over the last couple of years will actually work. They'll spend a lot of time on spacewalks inspecting the orbiter. They have all sorts of gizmos on extension arms and so on to look at the tiles and the various other heat shield parts of the shuttle. So a lot of it is just sort of to say, you know, are we confident enough now in our design that we can pick up the pace a little bit? Because if they can't pick up the pace of the space shuttle launches, NASA's going to run out of time long before they run out of components and other things that they really need to bring up to the International Space Station. And I think they'll just have to declare it finished at some point, whether or not they, in fact, have everything up there that they wanted to have.
And the next launch, though, is scheduled, I think, next month.
That's right. End of August is the next one on the agenda. And so they're hoping to be able to pick up the pace. But, I mean, a lot of that depends on the data that they get back from this mission, whether everything's going to really work.
And indeed, David Kestenbaum, will the analysis work of going over the pictures that people are taking now and all the pictures that have been recorded already, that's going to be done there in Florida and in Houston as well?
Some of it's going to be quite quick. They're going to have briefings an hour and a few hours later. And then some of it, as I said, some of the pictures are actually on the solid rocket boosters, and some of it will take more detailed analysis that will take a couple days. But we heard them say it looked clean, right? They made some comment about that on the way up. So they didn't see anything obvious, at least.
And, Carl, as I understand it, obviously you're not listening to the voices of Bruce Buckingham and Rob Nabius or their equivalent when you're on your mission. You're just hearing this chatter back and forth.
Yeah, well, we were listening to the flight loops, and so we're you know, just the calls. It's a very business-like because, you know, in the event that there's a problem, you need to have a clear channel so you can relay information. So, yeah, you don't have the commentary.
Probably not necessary after how many rehearsals would you conservatively guess?
Oh, we do, you know, probably hundreds of simulations of launches, landings, aborts. And so, of course, this is the culmination of all that.
And, David, just before we have to leave, would you remind us who's on board and who are going to be the stars as this mission continues?
Well, there are seven astronauts on board. I'll just mention Thomas Ryder is a German, a European Space Agency, and he's going to be actually delivered to the International Space Station for 6 months. He was on Mir for 6 months, so he'll be nearing, at the end of this, a full year in orbit. Three of the astronauts have never been in space before. Mike Fossum was in your class, Carl, right?
Well, Mike actually, he and I had applied when we were in the Air Force together, and he came in much later, but he kept applying, and, you know, one of those things, you know, never give up, and he never did. He was very persistent and finally got his chance to fly.
So he's been emailing you, you said, yes?
Yeah, I got a couple of emails. He was very excited about flying, and, of course, he's the first graduate from Texas A&M to fly, so he's very excited. All the Aggies are very proud.
The other Mark Kelly is the pilot. He's been in space before. Lisa Nowak and Stephanie Wilson are mission specialists. They're going to be moving the robotic arms and unloading the space shuttle. They have not been in space before. Pierce Sellers is British. I felt bad for him when he was he's English. Felt bad for him when he was on the launch pad and England had lost in the World Cup and the launch got scrubbed. And Tomas Ryder, who I mentioned before.
His name is what, Sellers? Presumably they call him Inspector Clouseau.
It's Piers.
Piers. I see. Not quite the same. Carl Walls and David Kestenbaum with us from the Kennedy Space Flight Center in Florida. Richard Harris is with us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And again, if you're joining us late, the shuttle Discovery launched from the Kennedy Space Center at about 38 minutes past the hour and has now achieved orbit. The separation of the solid rocket boosters proceeded without a hitch. There was main engine cutoff, and then the main fuel tank also separated, again, without a hitch. And Richard Harris, as we look ahead towards this mission, obviously everybody wants it to be flawless, but this late in the program, you're still describing this as flight test?
Absolutely. I think that NASA realized it made a mistake in calling the space shuttle program operational. In fact, it should have been, according to Admiral Gaiman, who investigated the Columbia disaster, it should have always been considered experimental. And I think NASA has changed its attitude. So the remaining space shuttle flights will be. I mean, some of the jet pilots who were testing jets and so on, and then were asked to investigate the Challenger or the Columbia disaster, mm-hmm. were sort of surprised to hear that this was considered operational because, you know, it's been, you know, 114 or so missions, and they were saying that, gee, that's really just getting going on a flight test program for a real aircraft. We wouldn't consider something operational after just 100 flights or 200 flights. So I think NASA had realized, oops, time to realize that this is going to be an experimental craft for the rest of its life.
Indeed, they realized every craft they have ever sent with a human aboard has been an experimental flight.
Absolutely, yeah.
As we look towards the completion of the International Space Station, whether they declare it completed or whether indeed all the parts are there, what are they doing now? I mean, obviously they've had to bank down on some of their activities as they've had very little in the way of spare parts, the extra equipment to build onto the space station, to extend it.
Indeed. And they've been down to a crew of two since the Columbia disaster or shortly thereafter. So they've only had two people up there. They assumed, actually, that the two people up there would only be able to do maintenance and do nothing else. In fact, they have been able to do some modest experiments and so on. So it hasn't been simply caretaking. It has been some activity up there. But they're trying to make the best of a situation that is clearly not the way they had envisioned it when they thought about what the space station was going to be all about.
And at this point, the space station itself is described as a kind of a strange place to live, a little rickety for one thing.
Yeah, not as bad as its predecessors, I think, particularly some horror stories from the Russian space stations and so on. But yeah, it's not going to have all of its components. It's not going to have some of the most important components for studying biology at very low levels of gravity. So yeah, it's less than perfect.
Carl Walls, are you still with us? No, I think Carl Walls has left us there in Florida, as he and David Kestenbaum have left our site. So we'll thank them for their participation today, NPR science correspondent David Kestenbaum and also astronaut Carl Walls, a veteran of 4 space flights, logged 231 days in space, among them time on Mir, I think. So I wanted to ask him about that. So he has left us for now. Obviously, we'll have continuing coverage of this story later today on NPR News. So stay tuned for that. But Richard Harris, as we look at this point, NASA has to be very pleased.
Yes, I think they really needed this launch. I think that the feeling among analysts is that if anything really major happens to the space shuttle at this point, that's the end of the program, probably the end of the International Space Station, certainly construction. There's still Russian spacecraft can still bring a few people up, and Europeans are developing systems to bring up some cargo, but the amount of cargo you can bring up is quite limited compared to what the space shuttle can bring up to the space station. It cannot bring up any large components that are sitting on the ground waiting to go there in Florida, including parts built by other nationalities who've invested a lot of money in the space station and really want to see it completed, want to send their own astronauts up and so on. So, yeah, unfortunately, NASA's in the position where every mission now has to be a real success or they will, you know, this run out of time so quickly.
And are they getting caught up also in the financial realities of President Bush's decision to say, we're going to finish that space station, then go back to the moon and to Mars?
Absolutely. That's the real issue. Well, there are two issues why the end of 2010 is the deadline, one of which is it costs a lot of money to run the shuttle program, and the money you're putting into that means you're not developing spaceships to go elsewhere. So that's one very critical point. The other thing is the commission that investigated the Columbia disaster said, really, if you are going to fly this, you can fly it for a few more years, but if you want to fly it beyond 2010, our judgment as aerospace experts is the vehicle needs to be recertified for flight, which basically means you have to pretend it's a new vehicle and say, would you approve this today if you were looking at it from afresh? And the reality is the first flight was 1981. This is 1970s technology, basically. I mean, with some significant upgrades along the way, but the basic vehicle is an old vehicle, and NASA doesn't think that they want to go through the time and expense and trouble of seeing if they can recertify it for flight. And I think that they are, really sticking to that 2010 deadline, so it would appear.
Richard Harris, thanks very much. I expect we'll be hearing more from you later in the day as well. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris here with us in Studio 3A in Washington. Again, the shuttle Discovery has launched from Florida and achieved orbit. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington.